a week or two ago, my idea or suggestion for a cold open was, I watched the first episode of season 3 of The Bear with Lisa. Mm-hmm. And, one thing that was like almost a motif, I guess, in that episode was this idea of cutting the edges of your green tape labels.
Tape. Yeah.
Like it was definitely a visual motif where it was like there were shots of people intentionally cutting with a knife, a paring knife, the edges of their green tape food labels.
Yeah.
And Lisa made this, well, maybe it was a snide remark on reflection, but Lisa made a remark. Oh, you know, those guys are real chefs because they're cutting their label tapes. And I was like, fair enough.
How right she was.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I guess so. Yeah. I mean, but there was something, that blew my mind recently, Shale. And I'm really excited to share it with you. Cause I feel like if you had come across it, you would have shared it with me. Okay. And it's a gadget called, I think it's called a frog. Okay. And basically, because all serious chefs use green painter's tape to label their food products in the kitchen.
Right.
But then there's the kind of pesky business of, you know, you can't tear it because then it looks really sloppy. And so we have all these different ways of cutting it cleanly so that you get square edges on the tape labels. There is a product called a frog that with an elastic band kind of you can affix to a roll of green painter's tape and kind of shuffle it along, and it has a serrated blade that you can lift the green painter's tape up and get a clean cut on the serrated edge of the frog, and then advance the frog around the roll.
Oh.
Yeah. And it blew my mind.
Cool.
It's a very niche product, but can you picture it? Did I describe that okay? Or
I think so. It's interesting because, yeah, I can't exactly picture it, but like what I have seen before is just like a dispenser for green painter's tape that has a cutting edge on it, and you can just pull the tape off and cut it on the cutting edge.
Right. Like one of those, like there's similar products for, especially for the clear heavy duty packing tape, right? Like where you can just pull the tape out, cut it along the edge, and
yeah very similar to that. So but what you're talking about is like this thing attaches to the roll of tape, so you just put the tape down anywhere, but it's got the cutter attached to it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I've also seen like those like cutting painter's tape like roll holders that will like that you can attach like to the wall and stuff like that. Oh, in really? Kitchens.
Oh,
yeah.
So this is a known issue that people have. There are industry solutions out there already.
Yeah, there are, but I feel like there are a lot of nitpicks that hopefully we can get into in our additional conversation later on in the episode.
Our episode on food labels?
That's right.
Okay, good.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. How are you, Alan?
Pretty good.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
You always do. When you ask me how I'm doing, and I like sometimes give like a hand waving, like, I'm fine, whatever. You sometimes yeah. you like do a, you like swallow or something. You like have to, you're, it looks like you take a beat and you're like, okay. Well, that's how he's doing. I don't know.
I think, it's not in a, usually in a reaction to the idea that you say that you're doing okay or that you're doing all right or that you're doing good. It's like, I think it's like a subconscious reaction to the fact that oftentimes when I ask you during the intro how you're doing, it like takes you takes you a couple seconds to respond. Like you're really thinking it through. And then, you know, like unfortunately for the listening audience, I usually cut that little pause out. So it just sounds like you're like immediately like, I'm good. But yeah.
I don't want to be flippant about it. You're asking me how I am.
You're totally right. Unfortunately, when it comes to the like edited recording of the podcast, it sounds probably sometimes like you are flippant about it. Sorry about that, Alan. Do you want me to leave your little pause in?
Well, I wouldn't want to seem disingenuous.
Yeah, no. I'll try to make it sound like you're really thinking about it, but you're doing it quickly.
Actually, I'm okay. Some business. Don't worry about it.
You kind of flipped our cold open on its head a little bit there.
Oh, is that right?
Well, sort of, because you were talking about an episode of The Bear, and that's actually what our episode's going
to
be about.
When we get to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We've got a lot of ground to cover between now and then.
All right, good. I'm glad.
But yeah, that's the topic, right? We're going to talk about...
we're going to talk about season 3 of The Bear, which... You've watched 4 episodes of, so we'll talk about it up to that point. I've watched a little further ahead than that. Well, only by 1 episode, I think. So, but we'll talk about up to episode 4. And this will be part 1, and then we'll do a part 2 that will be the rest of the episodes in the season. And hopefully this time when we get to the end, Carmi won't be locked in a fridge impossibly. So I won't have to complain about that for like half an hour on our show.
Don't worry, Shell. There's plenty to complain about, even if he's not in the cooler.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true.
But I had some, it's a bit of a reach, but some follow-up.
Okay.
But it's, Shell, there were, you know that we're noodle fans, right? Like we talk about noodles a lot. And
love noodles.
In the last few weeks... Noodles have been in some very prominent news stories. And I don't know, maybe you've heard about these, maybe you haven't, but I wanted to share them with you and kind of get your hot take.
Okay, I'm
so
ready.
I've got two...
I'm a hot take machine.
I don't know what that means.
It means I have bad opinions about everything.
Okay, so two news stories. The first one, this is from... it's from CNN on June 27th. And
CNN, that still exists?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear it then.
The first line of the story is, South Korea's highest mountain is facing environmental damage from an unexpected source, instant noodles.
No.
Do you know this story?
Why? No. I haven't heard this.
Okay, well, it goes on to say the National Park Office of Mount Hala has started a campaign to encourage hikers not to dump ramyun broth on the mountain or in its streams in order to preserve a, quote, clean environment, according to a press release.
Oh, no.
So this is a story of apparently there's a social media angle here where people like to climb high peaks and eat instant noodles and take pictures of themselves doing so.
Sounds nice.
But according to this article in CNN, people are not consuming all of the broth and then dumping it on the ground or into the streams, and it's affecting the creatures that need those streams to live.
That's unfortunate.
And so they've posted signs all over this mountain suggesting to people that they... only make half of the broth or only Yeah, only make it. That's problematic, I know, because obviously, sounds like tricky. The concentration will be affected, but they're specifically putting signposts up just to affect people's ramyun consumption.
Did the article say anything about whether it's mostly tourists or whether it's Korean people or?
Yeah, they talk a little bit about that. For instance, that the opening days of this kind of crackdown, a lot of the people who are being issued fines are tourists. It's not all for instant noodle consumption or disposal. A lot of it just is like jaywalking and stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, they do specifically mention tourist behavior, yeah.
I mean, it's disappointing. You know, like, leave no trace. That's
right. What do they say in
a simple rule.
In Alan. Canadian national parks, they say, take only pictures, leave only footprints.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that that's a pretty hard rule for a lot of people to follow, but yeah, it's still disappointing to hear that natural beauty is being destroyed by noodles. I just, man, that's really sad to me, Alan.
Okay, sorry.
Because noodles should be a force for good. That's
true. Yeah. Well, that's not the only instance of noodles. Sorry, it was almost a pun, but not quite. It's not the.
I think it's a good pun.
Not the only instance of noodles in international news in the last few weeks, Jill. The BBC, no less than the BBC, June 12th, they reported how this ties in so many ways, Jill. Okay. Quote, Denmark has recalled several spicy ramen noodle products by South Korean company Samyang, claiming that the capsaicin levels in them could be poisonous to consumers.
Oh.
Did you hear this story?
No, I didn't hear this story.
Capsaicin be poisonous? Is that even possible?
I don't know if it can be poisonous, but I no. did hear secondhand another news story about a Canadian, I believe, who had a heart attack after eating the one chip challenge from Pocky.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if it can like technically be poisonous, like in the way that it like, you know, would.
In the way that the word would mean.
Yeah, but like it can cause you to have like a really intense physiological reaction that could be dangerous, I think, for some people. And so, yeah, I've been hearing, I haven't heard that one specifically. and it's kind of ironic because I don't really think of Danish people as eating all that much spicy food. So it's kind
of
funny.
That's the problem, Shell. They're like, oh, there's garlic in this? I don't know. Maybe we should take it off the shelves. Just kidding.
But yeah, I also think it's just ridiculous, like the amount of like spicy challenge foods that there are. I just think it's so dumb.
So you're defending the Danish like government. It. You're backing the Danish government on this one, eh?
Oh yeah, 100%. Take stupid spicy challenge foods off the market. Makes no difference to me.
Well, I don't know if this. I haven't tasted these products, but just reading the descriptions, it doesn't sound like some kind of machismo, hot ones, spicy no? challenge. Like they're just, it's to quote the article, it's three fiery flavors of the Samyang instant ramen line.
Do you think they like accidentally have too much capsaicin in them, or do you think they're just like, this is normally how the product is? And
well, yeah, no, they specifically, they address that in the article. It's like the manufacturers say, We understand that the Danish Food Authority has recalled the products, not because of a problem with quality, but because they were too spicy. And there's, several iterations of that where it's like, it's not a quality problem. There's no mistake. It's just,
So the formulation is correct, but yeah, they're just too spicy for Danish people.
Yeah. And when you like the description of the products, like it's, as it appears on the packaging, like it's, you know, spicy and hot chicken, spicy and hot chicken stew. Like it's not, there's not the kind of like, it's not a, to me, it doesn't read like a.
Right. It doesn't sound like the sales pitch is like, this is so spicy that you can't handle it. And right, therefore you should buy it and try it.
Right.
Something. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think I'd have to do more digging, but I'm anti-spicy challenge foods, and right, I guess I'm pro Danish people expanding their horizons a little bit.
Chill. We need to eat these ramen packets.
I bet there's a big surplus somewhere right now, and you're going to need to break into a Danish warehouse.
I'm sure they just dump them right into the North Sea. Once they've been recalled, it's just straight into the ocean.
Oh, Alan, that's bad for the environment.
Oh, shoot. That would, yeah, you're right. That would probably throw the pH of the North Sea off. You're right.
Yeah. We're like breaking into a warehouse, like Indiana Jones style. There's like all these like crates, all these old dusty crates, and we're like going through and trying to find the ramen packets.
We're just shoving packets of dry noodles into our mouths and
these aren't the ones. I got some spicy noodle packets lately, actually.
Oh yeah,
some Korean ones that were like spicier than I expected. Can't remember which ones they were. There's like a cheese one, what's that brand called? Baldock or something like that.
That's what this brand means. Is Bulldog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they're
Buldak. Bulldog. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the actual.
So you have them.
I have them. Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of spicy. They're pretty spicy. I don't know if I have the same ones. I have the cheese one, and it's like surprisingly spicy. It's delicious. And the spice packet is kind of separate, so you can kind of make it as spicy as you want. But yeah, they're pretty tasty. But yeah, if you put it in that whole spice packet, they definitely, it's like, you know, it wasn't like the kind of experience that I had eating some spicy food where you like eat it and then you're like just ruined. Like you can't eat anything else and you can't taste anything and your eyes are just like watering and you just sit there for like 45 minutes in pain. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything close to that, but it definitely made my tongue feel like pretty fiery. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. They're good. Do you want me to bring you a pack?
Sure, but sorry, it's a cheese? Like, is it like, it's got a dried cheese packet?
Yeah, it has like powdered cheese packet in it. Yeah, it's like eating Kraft dinner.
Oh, really? Yeah, that sounds great.
It's like instant noodle. Yeah, yeah. And it's spicy. It's good. And I have another one of their flavors too, I think, another one of their spicy flavors, but I can't remember which one it is.
I'm really surprised how you received this information that I gave you. Well, the very fact that like the BBC is saying that the Danish government says that this is so hot that it's poisonous to me is like obviously not true, because I don't think there's like a known toxicity level for capsaicin. So to me it is silly, but
seems like nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to any of our British listeners, but like, I kind of.
sorry. Sorry. Go on.
But like, since Brexit, et cetera, I just don't. I have trouble taking the British media and like British like opinions around like politics and the world seriously. So I don't know, as soon as you said the BBC, I was like, okay, what? Here
oh
comes
my goodness. I specifically, because like both of these stories, the one about the Korean mountain trail and this one about the Danish recall, like they were picked up by news agencies around the world. And so I picked what I thought were two of the most reputable ones I could possibly
reputable news sources.
CNN yeah. and BBC. It never crossed my mind that you would scoff at a news story from the BBC, but
yeah, maybe I shouldn't, but that's just my gut feeling now. It's just like,
yeah.
When I hear British news, I'm like, oh, here comes a whole bunch of hot takes or something.
So in the future, if I'm bringing international news stories, I should be pulling from Fox Channel or
ouch. I mean, if I'm like looking at a news story and I have questions about like its authenticity or like, you know, how editorialized it is or something like that, I usually feel a little better if I see that it's like from the Associated Press.
Okay.
Or something like that. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't really trust The Guardian anymore, which is another like
British. Well, I was going to say, a few weeks ago we pulled from The Guardian for that David Chang Momofuku piece, but
yeah, which I feel like a lot of the stuff in that piece was like very editorial.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Like and not very factual and So I don't know, Alan. I feel like any news story that I read now where I'm like, oh, this sounds like weird or something, I'm just always looking for like corroboration rather than like what the source is, you know? Mm. I don't know. Got any more bad noodle news?
Bad Noodle News was the name of my heavy metal band in high school.
That's a terrible name.
No. No more follow-up show.
Okay.
And I regret even bringing what I did to the table.
Well, it's important for me to know about what's going on with spicy noodles in Denmark. I mean, like, there's a lot of crossover there for sure.
It's a huge, like, besides the fact that we've done multiple episodes on noodles, it's just like, it's in Denmark. And
yeah, exactly.
I lived
for almost an entire year. And I have like a lot of cultural sort of connection to the food culture there. So it's,
and I have a feeling that if we're going to discuss season 3 of The Bear, or at least the four
that we're going to wind up talking about Denmark,
we might end up talking about Denmark.
Yeah. That's a good point. Before we move on to that though, I'm just going to like, I'm dying to talk to you about the thing that I was going to use as a cold open. So I'm just going to talk to you about it now. I got to do something really fun this week. So a few, like maybe a month or so ago, the owners of Kind Ice Cream were at like a Edmonton City Business Owners kind of event and a networking event, I guess you might call it. I don't really know.
I've heard of those, yeah.
And they ran into this guy who is the CEO of a cryogenics company.
Okay.
That's based out of Edmonton. And I guess he is like a fan of Kind Ice Cream and he was like talking to them about it. And he was like, oh, you should come by and see our facility sometime. And he's like, and I think he asked them like, have you ever made like, you know, cryogenic ice cream? Like, have you ever made ice cream with like liquid nitrogen or anything like that? And I think they were like, well, no. And
what's the,
but then
chill, I'm sorry, what's the definition of cryogenic?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't actually know. Like it did occur to me to think about it this past week, but like, but yeah, I don't know exactly what the definition is. I think like, I mean, it's cold. Like, you know, it's like reducing the temperature of things to a level that is like not otherwise available in nature, I guess, or something like that is sort of what I guess the definition would be. But that may not be exactly right because I'm sure that the temperatures in space in a lot of cases are like lower than a lot of the temperatures of cryogenic materials and stuff that we have on Earth. So, I don't exactly know what the definition is, but cold stuff is like the
definition. in my mind, just because of pop culture, like it's like cryogenics just specifically means freezing someone so that they can
freezing people.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
That's not probably, it's probably a little bit broader than that. Is that
right? It's a lot broader than that. Yeah. It's basically using, it's like the science of like reducing the temperature of things or using materials that operate at extremely low temperatures. Mm-hmm.
So when he said, when this guy said, have you ever made cryogenic ice cream? What does that even mean?
I don't know. I wasn't there, so I don't know what the reaction was. But I think like what he meant was like, have we made ice cream using like liquid nitrogen or anything like extremely cold, like any other cold materials or mm-hmm. something like that?
Okay.
And yeah, what this company does is not freeze people's brains to put them in bottles or anything like that.
Disappointing.
sorry, Alan. What they do is make chambers. They make vacuum chambers for cryogenic experimentation. And they use liquid helium to pull the heat out of these chambers, like on various levels of like plates. It's really kind of difficult to describe, but basically they sell these like vacuum these cold vacuum chambers to like academic institutions and companies that do experimentation with cryogenics. Okay. A lot of that right now in the market has to do with quantum computing is like something where there's a lot of research money going into it right now, and for the most part, like all quantum computing experimentation like right now has to take place at extremely low temperatures. Like the temperatures that they're talking about are like below a tenth of a degree above absolute zero or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which is just like, it's colder than space. It's like crazy cold. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got invited to tour their facility, and I brought a whole bunch of like ice cream stuff with me, and we got to like make ice cream with like basically everyone in their whole company. It was like their company's birthday, and we went there with a bunch of people from our kitchen, and we got to like make ice cream with liquid nitrogen, and we got to try like some other little experiments with liquid nitrogen. I tried to make Dippin' Dots, which sort of turned out, didn't turn out exactly how I expected. It was crazy. It was super fun. We got to like, you know, so you can just make ice cream by like putting like ice cream base, like custard or whatever, in a bowl and just pouring liquid nitrogen into the bowl while you're stirring it. And it just gets so cold that it instantly turns into ice cream. And it's like so incredibly smooth because it freezes so fast that the ice crystals are just like non-discernible. So it's just like the smoothest ice cream you've ever tried.
And
it was great. It was a lot of fun.
But it was obviously not a kitchen that you were working in. You were just like, you had these bowls and you're just dumping like, you know,
they set up like a picnic table in the back of their kind of like they build all these things there. So they have like a crazy CNC machine, and they have like a metal shop. They do a lot of work with like copper and aluminum, and so they have like a very specialized metal shop with like laser welders and all this like really cool equipment. But just in the back of their metal shop, they just had like a big overhead door, and they opened it up and they set up a table back there, and we just sort of had like a picnic table and a huge, the biggest dewar of liquid nitrogen that I've ever seen. It was like I don't even know, it was probably must have been like 300 liters or something like that. I don't know if it was full or not, but it was gigantic. And then they just like pumped liquid nitrogen out of this huge tank into a tiny little like handheld kind of like pouring vessel with an open top, like a vacuum bottle. And we got to play around with a bunch of that stuff. It was super fun.
I went to one place in San Francisco. I think like you and I traveled to San Francisco together once.
Yeah.
I don't think it was this trip, but another one, there was an ice cream shop where they had liquid nitrogen lines like piped in over the service counter. And when you,
man, that's so they crazy.
Would like when you order a scoop of ice cream, they would freeze it to order. And they had basically just like countertop stand mixers with a paddle attachment. They would put the base right. in, and then mix it. And then, the nozzle of liquid nitrogen would, be pushed into the bowl and they would freeze it to order. When will kind do that?
I mean, the whole time I was there, my like, I was just like thinking of like ideas for why or how we could potentially do something with liquid nitrogen ice cream, because it's so fun. It's like such a cool demonstration to show people.
Yeah.
You get like this, you know, like you're pouring liquid nitrogen into a bowl and the fog is just billowing up over the top yeah. and like going everywhere on the floor. It's just like it looks really cool.
Science center stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, I think somebody, while we were there, I think somebody said that they do that at the science center sometimes.
I've actually attended that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Basically yeah. daily in one of the auditoriums at the TELUS World of Science at Edmonton, they make ice cream with liquid nitrogen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, like, I've worked with liquid nitrogen before in several kitchens, but we never actually made ice cream with it. We were using it to make other frozen desserts and things like that, and like using it to like freeze leaves, like, and then break them and turn them into dust and stuff like that. But yeah, I never actually like made ice cream with it before. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty fun. Yeah, anyways,
we'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the ideas are churning in my brain right now.
Terrible.
I know, I'm sorry. Anyway, should we talk about The Bear season 3?
We can try.
Okay.
Let's do it.
I watched the episodes, like I said, I think I watched up to episode 5, and then earlier today I sort of skimmed them again and made some notes. So okay. I have a few things jotted down that hopefully will spark some conversation.
That's good. Can I definitely don't have...
You have an opening statement?
I don't have notes written.
Okay.
But we should start at the beginning. And episode 1 of season 3...
Yeah.
First of all, it's a 30 or 40 minute montage.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
and there exactly. is no new information.
I wouldn't say that
the plot. Well, okay, sorry. Let me rephrase that. The plot is not advanced at all. There is yeah. maybe some, there might be some new information about Carmi's experiences at these upper echelon restaurants, but yeah. I was pretty frustrated with the first episode.
Were you?
Yeah. I mean, it,
yeah,
it really, I'm not being poetic. Like it is just a 40 minute montage.
Yeah.
Scene to scene to scene. No, it's just flashbacks and vibes and little snippets. I think that probably what most people we'll talk about when they talk about this first episode is the cameos,
right?
By,
well, people in the know, I think, would, but
yeah, but then like the people in the know, like they're watching it with their spouses and their annoyed friends and right. being like, oh my God, that's Daniel Ballud. That's Daniel Ballud. That's Renee.
Well, I'm a people in the know, and I wasn't like that.
So. Well, maybe in your head.
I wasn't. I promise. Okay. I wasn't like that. Yeah.
And
okay, maybe I was a little bit like that.
Of course when you were. in a way, they're very gratifying because one of the kind of mild complaints that I've had with some of the previous seasons is you take something like when... Marcus, who's the baker at the Bear. Marcus is sent on a on an internship to Copenhagen, and it's a
one of my favorite episodes.
It's a good episode, and certainly the conversations that he has with the pastry chef that he's working with there, like it's interesting and everything. But there's something about that episode that feels it's very bottled, and it doesn't feel like he's actually working in a living kitchen. It's like you don't see very many people around. Like, I understand he's a baker and he's working at odd hours, but there's something about it that feels very canned and not natural. And I expect that has to do with whatever budget and logistics for filming this show. And so that's been something it's not a huge deal, but something that I've noticed in episodes in the past where it's like, well, is this really what a kitchen would look like? Like there's not enough people, there's not enough energy, there's not enough whatever. And so I feel like this first episode of the third season is trying to imbue a little bit of that, where it's like, well, yeah, he did, like he was in New York and he worked for Daniel Boulud, like, and here's Daniel Boulud showing him how to cook the fish. And we know he was in Copenhagen, and like, here's him at Noma, and good Lord, there's Rene Redzepi. So I appreciate that, but it was odd to me for the entire, episode to be a montage, and Rene, especially the glimpse of Rene that you get it's almost like Rene Redzepi is like, you know, like a deer in the wilderness, and like you're like, oh, is that it? That is Rene. And then you know, it literally is like a 3-second appearance. And it's just him like, you know, looking at a wall of Polaroids or something. But so I don't know. It was cool. It was like a little bit of fleshing out, I guess, of Carmi's professional backstory, which has been some things they've spelled out pretty clear in terms of his work experience, and other things have been more vague. And so it was cool to see some of it become more specific, which actually, and we'll talk about it maybe for the subsequent episodes in season 3. But yeah, as a piece of storytelling, like I thought the first episode was kind of bullshit. Like it was not, I don't know that.
Okay.
Tell me, Shell, what did you think of it?
Well, I'm sure that, okay. Here's what I thought of it. I really loved it. I certainly understand your reaction. While I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, like, people's reaction to this is going to be like, what? Why is this a 30-minute montage with no story in it? Like, what? You know, here's this show I've been watching. I'm so excited. Did Carmi get out of the fridge? We don't even, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it occurred to me that like, you know, a lot of people's reaction is going to be like, well, what, you know, like, what even is this? Like, what, you know, it's not the start of a new story. You know, like, we've left all this stuff, like all this drama or whatever, and none of it's being resolved. And I'm just, and like, you know, as you know, after the first 5 minutes, you're like, oh, okay, well now the story is going to kick in or whatever. They, you know, they showed Carmi like going away. Now the story is going to start to kick in. And then after 10 minutes, you're like, whoa, it's still just a montage. And then after like 15 minutes, you know, like, and I think that like for most people, and obviously in your case, was somewhat frustrating because you were maybe hoping for something else. But like for me, I don't know, maybe, you know, like, I guess, like, to some extent, you know, I'm getting something different out of the show than most people probably will be, you know, like, for me, watching it, it's sort of like, you know, because of spending so much time in kitchens and thinking so much about food and, you know, thinking about those restaurants that they, you know, say that Carmi went and worked at and things like that, like, there's a powerful nostalgia thing there for me. And that's like a part of the show that like really, I don't know, just like inherently makes me feel like it is more knowledgeable about some obscure aspects of my own experiences that no show that I've ever watched has any access to.
Right.
And I really like that about the show. And the first episode of the third season for me, like, really laid into a lot of those things and did it in a way where, like, you know, I think in the previous seasons, like, some of the food photography is, like, pretty nice and, you know, not that they're not doing a good job with it, but like you said, like, you know, the kitchens don't feel real in a lot of cases, or, like, you know, they're, like, doing, like, really nice food photography. They're focusing on, like, one dish. But in this episode, it's just, like, dish after dish after dish, and it feels more like a real restaurant, you know, like they're taking pictures of like all this food and like all these jobs that he's doing and all these tasks in all these different locations, and it just like made it feel a lot more kind of real to me. And I really enjoyed that.
Definitely.
I really for me, like, the music was amazing. I loved the music in it, and so I was just like kind of mesmerized like by the music and all these like beautiful shots.
Can you remind me, so like I don't specifically remember the music in episode one, but I know that certainly by the third episode of the third season there was basically gorgeous classical music playing, not just in the way that there's kind of like the famous opening credits of Chef's Table, like the Netflix show Chef's Table, that is just like this, you know, over the top, I think, I don't know, it's Vivaldi or something. It's like this crazy, strings going wild and whatever, like it's there to like make everything seem so grandiose. But in the third episode of season three of The Bear, there's these kind of similar, you know, string music happening that, but it's also showing like all of the ugly things in the kitchen. So there's like definitely these moments of, the ballet, the dance, the precision, the whatever it is. But then there's also just like pots boiling over and like stuff. And
huge
it really,
spills and pots boiling over and broken dishes. And
so I don't know if that's the same kind of thing that was happening in the first episode, but
I don't actually remember what the musical stuff was like in the third episode, but in the first episode, it's kind of like, it's kind of this motif that keeps repeating. It's a sort of the same music, just sort of like goes throughout the entire montage / episode. And
but not classical, right? Like it's more like, it's just vibey rock.
It's very similar to the music in movies like The Social Network and stuff like that, because it's composed by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Oh, really?
So it's like, so it's like this kind of cinematic, like musical idea that we've come to sort of attach to that kind of vibe or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It just really worked for me. I don't know if they have anything to do with the music in the rest of the show, or if that's a piece that they made that then the show just used or something, like that it was from something else, or I'm not quite sure how that all came together, but I don't know. Music really worked for me. But like, I think the part that I enjoyed the most about the first episode is that like it does subtly tell a story, and it does subtly give you new information and new insight into Carm's character. And in a way that like, you know, you're just sort of watching this montage happen and like, it's not like, but like as you're watching it and throughout, you're piecing together this story about how he needed to get away from his family And he took this opportunity and he went. And then he did a lot. You know, he was away for a long time and he was off on his own doing this, like, you know, having this like transformative experience, mm-hmm. In good and bad ways, obviously. We get to spend more time with like his, chef who, bullies him or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Which, like, was, you know.
Yeah. And I, yeah. actually that wasn't in, that was.
They don't really expand on that much. It's just sort of like more of the same with that. But like, sorry, go
there,
ahead.
I was going to say there was one. So yeah, they're kind of like one of the most resonant flashbacks from the first season is him. They don't tell you that restaurant. I'm quite sure it's Levin Masson Park. But yeah, this flashback where the chef de cuisine is berating him and the kind of like real gut punch at the end as he says that you should be dead. And it's almost silly. It seems silly like when you just describe it that way, but like it really lands and like is a kind of core point of his anxiety and depression, I think, is the way that man talks to him. So you see a lot more interactions between, cause I think it's just one scene that guy has, kind of bully chef has in the first season as a flashback.
Yeah, that's right.
But then you see a few interactions with him and Carmi in these flashbacks in the opening to the third season. There is one of the most interesting things of the episode to me was that there is something like encouragement in him. In one
particular, he shows him subtract or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Like the only, like he's still being an ass, like he's still being cruel,
being a bully.
But he says the only way you're going to get better, and then he just writes the word subtract on his green tape that we've already talked about, right? Yeah. Like to focus the flavors and everything. And so
the real gut punch of the thing that he says in this episode, though, is like, I think they're standing there and Carmi's plating a dish and he looks at it and he's like, maybe we've just reached the end of where your talent can go.
Yeah.
It's just like,
there's actually a lot of, all of the lines that are written for, what's that guy's, Joel McHale's character are actually quite good.
Oh, right. I forgot that's Joel McHale. Yeah.
Like just things like, this needs to get better or it needs to go away. Like that's something a chef would say to you.
Crazy,
it was
rough lines.
Yes. But that one, not that it redeems the character at all, but like I said, there was a whiff of encouragement there where it's like, we need to focus this.
Yeah.
But then, you know, and then it switches almost immediately to, it's basically that chef de cuisine says, okay, take away this and add fennel. And now this is my dish, just so you know, like this
right.
is, and actually that particular scene, I actually laughed out loud because I had told, like I had it in my mind and I had told students now for years that like this idea, fish, citrus, fennel, these three, like seafood, citrus, fennel is so magical and just works so well. And I saw it again and again and again in the 11 Madison Park cookbook. And so I started saying it to students. It's like, if you're trying to build a dish, like
use this
seafood, citrus, fennel, like it works. It's magic. It's classic. It's timeless. It's, one of the, sorry, I'm kind of jumping around, but like another thing that has been nice about the third season is that it does flesh out in a very specific way Carmi's work experience. And so we know that he went, I think, from Chicago to a stagiaire's position at I think the first place he went was French Laundry, actually.
At Daniel.
Oh, I think that there's.
I don't think so, because like when he's leaving, like when he's leaving and he's saying goodbye to Natalie mm-hmm. Sugar or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that's when he's leaving after the big family blowout. Mom drives the car through the living room, whatever.
Right.
His aunt had said, come and stay with me in New York. And then when he's leaving town, I think that's where he's going. He's leaving to go stay with his aunt in New York. And then the first place that he goes to, I think, is Daniel, because that's in New York.
So you think he goes yeah. from New York to California?
I think so.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't know exactly at what point, but yeah.
The only
there's no real specific timeline. But.
The only reason that, in my head, I have a different timeline because we know that he goes to the French Laundry. And then sometime after that, we know that he is at a, before this season, we only know that it is a 3-star Michelin restaurant in Chicago. We learn later in the season that it's Ever, like the name of the restaurant is Ever. And right. that's where,
which is a fictional restaurant.
No, Ever is a real restaurant.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. But before they told us that that's the name of the restaurant, I didn't pick up on whatever clues they were giving. And so I assumed that it was based off Alinea.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was assuming too. I didn't realize I didn't catch that Ever thing. And then also I just assumed it was a fictional restaurant because the chef is Chef Terry. And
yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, and so the reason that I think that he went to California before going to New York is because, we see a flashback of him, talking to Chef Terry and she asks, where have you worked before? And all he says is mm-hmm. the French Laundry. Or all right.
Oh.
And so that's when she says, well, have you been to Copenhagen? And so
right. And she sends
to
it.
Me, yeah. It's not really important, but like to me, it's the timeline is, the family restaurant in Chicago, California, back to Chicago, and then Copenhagen in New York. But I don't really know. But you do see, so definitely he was at the French Laundry. It's interesting because I don't know if you remember, one of our conversations about the previous seasons, there was this interesting, they suggested that he was the chef at a restaurant in California, presumably fictional,
right.
called
yeah, Ferris. Like his own restaurant.
Yeah, called Ferris. Ferris yeah. Creatures or Fairer Creatures or something like that. Cause you right, see right. one of the menu, like printed menus, from that restaurant. So that it's interesting because they're kind of walking this line of like, yes, he has worked at, Restaurant Daniel. And like, here's Daniel Boulud showing him how to cook the fish. And he has worked at the French Laundry where we know Thomas Keller is the chef. And I think I've seen spoilers that, like Thomas Keller will be in an episode of this season really? Of The Bear. Okay. We've seen him at Noma and we've seen Rene Redzepi. But then we've seen him now at a restaurant that we know is Ever, but it's not the real chef. It's not, I can't remember the chef's name now, but it's not like it's a fictional chef at that, at right. that version of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And I
think, I'm not positive, but I think that the scenes in that restaurant are shot in Alinea.
Well, that's what I thought. Think. Like, I haven't been to these places, so I don't really know, but I was sure, like the scene of Rich, like going to his first day of work, at that restaurant, I was sure it was Alinea, just like from what I had read about the restaurant.
And I did see like a social media post where they were like in a restaurant with Grant Achatz. Like mm-hmm. they've been posting stuff like from the shoot, like they posted some stuff on Instagram from when they were at Noma and stuff. And,
right.
and they posted some pictures of like the cast with Grant Achatz. So like at Alinea. So I think that's what they were using as their set forever mm-hmm. or something like that. Another thing that's amazing about the the first episode is like all this location shooting. Like shows just don't do that.
Yeah.
Like shows don't fly their cast to like Copenhagen and shoot at Noma.
Right.
Like it's just, you know, it's like not a thing, you know, like it seems like they're really taking care to try and make it feel authentic, which,
I don't know,
like most TV just isn't like that,
yeah.
You know, which which is really what, you know, the biggest thing that I think that I enjoy about the show is like how they do try to lend some authenticity. I know I've had problems with some of the plotting and stuff and like, you know, some of the character motivations and things like that. But yeah, like in terms of like the food culture and stuff, I really do think that they try to pay as much attention as possible to making it authentic.
It was palpably different than like I mentioned that the episode where Marcus is staging in Copenhagen, where it just felt so.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel like a real kitchen at all. But like, no.
Although I think that episode was like largely shot in Copenhagen though as well.
Yeah. Like, and that I'm
sure felt like Copenhagen to me.
Totally. But like the kitchen scenes, it was like, it was two guys in an empty room kind of. But then like, you know, just seeing the range in Restaurant Daniel, I've seen, you know, videos of that particular custom built range that exists in that restaurant. And so that alone was like, oh yeah, no, like this is the place. And like, this is,
yeah.
Yeah. And even though it's shot as a montage and it's just kind of like, you hear Danielle Boulud talk, but it's not like it's kind of intercut with a bunch of other sound clips and in and out. And but it's still,
which is kind of why I think it needed to be done as a montage. You want to show, like, you want to have these cameos, you want to show these chefs, you want to maybe have Danielle Boulud talking, but Danielle Boulud is not an actor,
right?
Right. And you don't want to put Daniel Boulud in a situation where you're like getting him to read lines.
Of course. Yes.
Or something like this.
Well, you can tell, like, it seems so like you, something that he, like these things that he's saying to Carmi, it sounds like he would have trained, you know, dozens of other chefs where he's like, you can, like when you put the fish in the oil, you can hear it sing like that. Yeah. Those kinds of
just bring a camera in. They're like, Daniel, just do what you would do if you were training someone how to make this dish. You know, like. Which I think is like really smart. It makes it feel very authentic. And I understand why some people would be frustrated that the whole thing is a montage. But here, I'll wrap up my thoughts about it here so we can move on to not just talking about the first episode. But to me, it feels very important because the arc of the whole thing goes from, you know, him leaving town because he needs to get away from his family to him being away when his brother dies.
Yes.
Right. And that's a very important moment for his character. And there's like this, they're like dropping this hint throughout the episode that he like burned his hand, I think probably on purpose so that he could leave and go back for his brother's funeral or something like that. They don't actually show that. It's just sort of like maybe hinted at. I don't know if they'll get to that later in the season. It's kind of funny because all of the episodes are out right now. So it's possible that some listeners of the show have already seen the entire season and we've only seen the first four episodes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, like, you know, I expect that potentially, you know, we will find out that that's sort of what happened. It's also like alluded to in another episode where Claire notices it and kind of asks him about it in a flashback. But yeah, like to me, you know, it's sort of like the heart of Carmi's character is like this situation where he feels horrible for being away while his brother was having this crisis. And, you know, it ended in his brother taking his own life and Carmi being away and having to come back and feeling like, you know, he really blew it in that way. Like he wasn't there for his brother. And like the first episode, as much as it's like kind of this ephemeral montage, it like really, it like the whole thing is kind of to make that point that that's like, you know, where Carmi is coming from. That's what he has to prove now.
Right.
Is that, you know, he wasn't away for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't gone when his brother died on a whim. You know, this is like something that he takes very seriously or something.
And
to me it's important to the show because of that. And I understand why the format is probably weird for some people, But personally, I kind of liked the format, and I thought they did a lot of really amazing, thoughtful stuff with it too. Like, there's like this amazing callback to like the first time that Sid comes in to the beef right. and meets Carmy and tells him that like she ate his food at this restaurant mm-hmm. or whatever. And then they show her having that meal.
Yeah.
And they show that she was presented with a dish that was actually Carmy's creation.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know. It's like, I understand why the format might be challenging for some people, but man, there's some great creative writing in that episode. Like, I just feel like it's such a good episode of television.
Mm-hmm.
That I couldn't really be mad at it. I was put off a little bit when we were like 15 minutes in and I was like, this is still a montage. I was like, yeesh, there's people are gonna be like, what the hell is this? But mm-hmm. but man, yeah, I don't know. For me, it really landed.
Yeah, that thing with Sydney eating again, I'm just gonna call it 11 Madison Park, even though they don't actually, sorry, Shill. One thing that I noticed that kind of blew my mind is that, so Will Guidara, who was the founder of 11 Madison Park with Daniel
right.
Hume, and was still mm-hmm. the owner when they won Best Restaurant in the World, he is now an executive producer on this show.
Oh, cool.
or a consultant. I don't know, like his name was in the credits.
Yeah.
And we've talked about him because he wrote the book Unreasonable Hospitality that Rich was reading when he was doing his internship at Ever and stuff. So I feel like that's another, like that's definitely a source of a lot of the details of this, these types of restaurants. But also maybe is another reason why they're not actually saying 11 Madison Park, because he's yeah, a former yeah, owner of it, but anyways.
Yeah. Could be some legal stuff there.
Yeah. I actually basically forgot about that. The point about Sydney eating, cause she told right. us, in the first season that she ate at this restaurant when Carmy was the CDC
was
and that was
there.
The best yeah, meal she's yeah. ever had. And there was the whole, basically he serves her his version of the dish that the, mm-hmm. that the bullying chef, kiboshed, right? Like,
yeah. And that's like an amazing piece of storytelling yeah. during this montage too. Like they show iterations of that dish and
yeah.
they show him being berated for it. And they show him like, you know, they show him like crushing through a bunch of prep so that he can work on some things that are outside of yeah. like, you know, his normal things so that he can like make a blood orange reduction for this dish that he's working on and stuff. And how he's, you know, like, he's just like, you get glimpses of it throughout the episode and it tells this whole story of how he created it. And then it gets presented to Sydney.
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, that's like, I was just like, okay, that is like an amazing payoff. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It was
yeah,
good.
I agree. Okay. So that's the first episode, but Shill, the second episode, what a disaster. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Honestly, I feel like this whole episode of our podcast can basically just be like, you know, like the, you know, like I think the most important thing to talk about is the first episode. I think for the episode 2, 3, and 4, like, you know, definitely more happens in the story, but I think we can kind of like, you know, hit our highlights on them, you
yeah.
know, like now the story is getting into motion and, you know, like, and it's, I don't know, it's a little less. It's a little less interesting to me. I still think they're good episodes, but
it is, yeah. Well, you're right. It is less interesting. I will say, I didn't like the second episode at all.
Okay.
It's basically I think it's in the industry, Shale. It's called a bottle episode. Like it's an episode that takes place in one location with characters
right.
just arguing with each other. And actually like it definitely, you know, one of the hallmarks of this show now is like making people understand, stressful or making people experience, I guess, stressful, toxic work environments. And in that regard, this episode was wonderful. But like half of the dialogue was Carmi and Rich just screaming "fuck you" at each other, and and yes, that did make me experience the stress of a toxic work environment. But it was like not. I hated it. Like I didn't enjoy watching it. I didn't think it was very well crafted.
I agree. I agree with you.
But
it felt like they needed to do something about the fact that theoretically Carmi and Richie are mad at each other and can't just like apologize to each other and get over what was said through the cooler door or whatever, because it's going to be a part of the reconciliation later on in the season or something. Yeah. So they need to set up this thing that Carmi and Richie really can't communicate, even though they made up, like they got to such a good place in the previous season. I feel like this show does that a lot. It just like gives you character growth and then falls back on it, which isn't necessarily unrealistic, but like, it, you know, it just feels a little bit unsatisfying because it feels like, you know, they just have to have this like, you know, really, intense, like argument, stress, toxic workplace, you know, and so they just, they just write a bunch of FU dialogue, you know, or something. I don't know. It doesn't feel that great. There's one thing in this episode that I loved. There's a montage at the beginning of the episode that is basically just like shots of food businesses or hospitality businesses in Chicago. It's like 3 or 4 minute montage, like sort of during the credits or at the beginning of the episode. I love that. Yeah. It's just like real shots of people in Chicago, real restaurants. And, you know, they just like look happy to be doing their job on camera. It's just like I really liked it. I thought that was great. It just felt very grounded and very real.
Totally.
And then you get into the episode and you're right, you know, it's just sort of like this thing like, you know, Carmi's stressed and nobody's able to talk to each other and it's just kind of ridiculous. But I'm just curious, like, how do you feel about Carmi's list of non-negotiables?
Great question. They're all excellent except for the menu changes every day. That one's bullshit.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know.
I don't know if they're all excellent either. I think some of them, are like a little bit ridiculous. Like, you know, too subjective to be non-negotiables, but.
Yeah. The biggest thing is how they are presented. The fact that he's, you know, he's written them up and he's just kind of forcing them down everybody's throat, even though he's basically still in the midst of negotiating with potential partners like Sydney, importantly. Yeah. To have things like that just put in your face without any context or explanation is really just not a good move as a manager.
Yeah.
But most of them are like, if the goal, and this is his own objective, if the goal is to get a Michelin star, then, you know, they're generally pretty reasonable. I think that changing the entire menu every day is really foolish, but I don't know how it all plays out. Me having only watched the first 4 episodes of the season, I'm getting clues from the script that, you know, maybe service is a little bit uneven because they don't always understand the menu as well as they could. And maybe that will be something I can't remember if this was in the recording show, but like the last thing that I watched was that they suddenly became aware that they were being reviewed by the Chicago Tribune. And so maybe that's something that comes up in the review in the paper, is that like, the food's great, but like nobody really knows what's going on because the menu's changing every day. So I don't know. That was the only one that like really leaped out to me where it's like, well, that, I don't know if that's a smart thing to do. And
especially for like, you know, you just opened your doors and you're working with a bunch of people who have never worked in that type of restaurant before.
Yeah, that's right.
that type of environment. Like, the whole thing feels a little unrealistic to me, honestly, but
in terms of you mean that a crew, like, no one on that crew, except for, I guess, maybe Sydney.
Except for Sydney, maybe.
Yeah. Has worked, like, whatever Rich had is his week at a Michelin-starred restaurant. But, like, no one else.
Yeah, and Marcus had a stage in Copenhagen or whatever. But, yeah, there's no, yeah, like, you know, they've never run a station in a restaurant like that, or, you know, like, it's just not, you know, and then to have the menu change every day is just like, it's totally crazy, unrealistic, but, you know, but whatever. Yeah. Like,
and especially I think the dishes that they put up, like the dishes that they show, like, they're like, this is not a Blackboard bistro menu. This is like,
no, like exactly.
Things executed at a very high level that ornate plating.
Yeah. He calls it R&D, which makes sense, you know, like, he is trying to develop those dishes and he has a lot of experience making food like that. I don't think it's unrealistic that he could be that creative and make that.
Right, but the crew, right? You know? Like, it doesn't.
But yeah, the crew, how are they supposed to do that and change it every day? It's just not possible. I do think that what Carmi says about the non-negotiables is kind of true. Like, if they do want to get a star, if their goal is to get a star, then, which seems like a dumb goal, and that it seems like a goal that he didn't really want previously, and Sydney points that out. But anyway, you know, like, if the goal is to make it like a super high end restaurant and to get a star, like, he's right. That list of non-negotiables, that's how it is at starred restaurants. Those things are non-negotiable. Mm. You know, like, the care and the attention and everything having to be perfect, and perfect is perfect, perfect means perfect, or whatever, I think is one of them. You know, like, that's just how it has to be at that high level of a restaurant. And most of the people that he's working with don't understand that. And so I think, you know, it's his way of trying to communicate to them that that's how it's going to have to be if they want to, you know, really make it into what they all sort of like aspire for it to be or whatever. And he's maybe the only one that really understands that, or maybe Sydney, but, like, you know, it's just, yeah, it's just a ridiculous sort of like thing to dump on everyone, like, you know. Yeah.
And that's why actually one of the things that rang the most true for me was when Marcus comes back after like his mother dies. And I actually can't remember if this is before or after, like, her burial. But Marcus, you know, kind of reads the list of non-negotiables and looks Carmi in the eye and just says, "You've got to take us there." And that was the thing that rang the most true for me, was like, the crew beside Sid and Carmi, like, have no experience in this at all, but they,
totally.
You know, at least in Marcus, you see the desire and like the deference that they need to pay to Carmi, because he's the one who's been in that system for so many years. So I liked that scene, but
yeah. And then at the end of the episode too, there's like a weird conversation about tipping too, like people's opinions about tipping culture, which I thought was, I don't know, just kind of tacked on and didn't really feel very, I don't know, felt a little weird to me. But.
Yeah, it seemed like a conversation that wouldn't really need to happen in a restaurant of that caliber. I think mostly it was just a device for...
Well, I think it is a decision that you can make. Like, a decision could be like, yeah, we don't have tipping here, we just have like a service fee. Like, that's what they're trying to figure out, but they turn it into this sort of like political conversation about tipping.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of inject that, I think, into the show. That was like their way of like putting a bit of a political conversation about tipping into the show. But
it seemed more like
the conversation is just very kind of trite. Like, it doesn't
seem
really
more just like a tool for Rich and Carmi to have more arguments. Do you know what I mean? Like, they didn't really dive into why people feel about tipping, pro or con, in any
way. It did a little bit, which is why I found it annoying. Mm. Like, Richie was like talking about how it would be ridiculous if you like went to I can't remember exactly what he says, but he like, I don't know, likens it to going to the theater or something.
Oh,
I don't
know.
There's some like weird,
that's
like,
right, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. Wasn't my favorite. Episode 3 is like the beginning of it is Marcus's mom's funeral, and everyone from the restaurant is there, and Marcus gives what I thought was like a pretty down to earth, heartfelt eulogy.
Totally.
I really liked that. Yeah, then the rest of the episode is just like a little bit of like that. Oh, everything's got to be so stressful. I think in episode 3, there's a lot of that like sort of stuff that you were talking about where, yeah, they're showing like pots boiling over and things hitting the floor and everything's just like total chaos and everyone's supposed to be super stressed out. And Carmy gets extremely stressed out. Well, actually, kind of like one of my favorite lines in the episode is like Carmy is freaking out. Like it's near the end of the episode, I think. And Carmy's just about to have like a, I don't know.
Aneurysm?
Yeah, or something, like a breakdown or something. He's just like shaking because he's like so so angry or so impatient or whatever. And he's like, they're moving too slow or something, he says to Sydney. Right. He's swearing when he says it, I think. And she's like, you got to calm down. I'm not your fucking babysitter. That was like one of my favorite lines in the whole episode. Yeah, totally. She's just like, look, guy, like I'm not going to be here with you taking care of you if you can't take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, which, yeah. I mean, that's exactly how I feel about Carmy's character. Why is he such a, you know, like he's done all this, he's got all this experience, but he just like, he's just like off the rails. Which I don't really understand, but
yeah, well, that's just kind of the a lot of the interest that I feel for the show and for his character are
generated by why he's so toxic. Or,
because he is really on a razor's edge between like his dedication to the profession or whatever. Like on the one hand it makes him do great things, and on the other hand it makes him burn everything around him to the ground, kind of. And so that's the I don't know what that says about, you know, the industry and stuff, but like it, like that's the excitement for me, like in terms of this being a drama, is it's the tension between his devotion to excellence or his striving for excellence, but then at what cost? And
and I think like I think you're right, that's what the show is like trying to get at. I'm like curious to know if by the end of the third season if the show has anything, like the show is like depicting this like toxicity and like this really, you know, intense work environment, and it's like depicting that through what you just said about Carmy, you know, being unable to live his life in any kind of sustainable way because he's just on this razor's edge between these caring about these like intense things that are, you know, that are unmanageable. And I wonder if like there's a way for the show to have a point about where that comes from in the industry, you know, like, is there a way for the show to like illustrate what the cause of that is or something, like, you know, I don't know. It's weird. It's sort of like the show kind of wants to have its cake and eat it too at this point. It's like it wants to point it out, but it doesn't really have anything to say about how it could be better or why, you know, like why it is the way that it
is. Yeah, like it has to, like for this to have any kind of meaningful critique or resolution or whatever in my mind, like you have to understand that it's systemic. And it's not that Carmy is a nut job, although maybe he is. Like it, You have to understand that there's something in this system that encourages this attitude or that like rewards people who think that way. Like that's the only, to me, that's the only logical way for it to provide that meaningful critique. And I don't really see that, because I think that especially with Carmi, like everything about his all of his actions are so deeply rooted in his family history that I don't think that they're gonna, I mean, besides the bullying chef, like I don't see them kind of trying to lay that all on the feet of
to address it or like point a finger anywhere or something. Yeah,
especially now that Rene Redzepi and others are on the payroll, like I don't think they're gonna
right,
I don't know, is that a weird thing to say? Like
I
think that's that's another interesting tension, is like for instance, I read and sorry, I can't remember where it was published now, but like when Joel McHale was looking for inspiration for you know, how he would portray the bullying chef, like his inspiration was Thomas Keller.
Wow, really?
Yeah, who will later appear in this season, as I understand it. So like it's and surely he'll appear in some kind of like semi-spiritual way, you know, the same way that Rene Redzepi did.
Some kind of
way. And like these guys, whatever, like they were bullies at one time or another too. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's
I'm curious to see how it plays out in the rest of the season, whether there is something that can constructively be said about it, or, you know, whether the creators of the show are just hoping that they'll happen upon one at some point or something. I'm not really sure. Let's wrap this up. What did you think about episode 4?
What happened again? Cicero complained about costs. And
yeah, so the cost thing, there's sort of been an ongoing discussion of the costs, but Cicero brings in the computer to talk to them about, I think, oh no, that's actually in episode 5.
Oh, spoiler.
Sorry, spoilers.
I've really enjoyed the, like they're pretty quick and fleeting, but I've really enjoyed Cicero's, that's his name, right? That's the character's name?
I think so.
Like how difficult, bordering on impossible it is for them to make any money. And Sugar's,
that's actually really interesting
insights
to me.
Just like, it's like, okay, well, we're doing 2 turns. Like, can we do 2.5 turns? And then how difficult that is for the team to do that. Like it's almost impossible to, you know, 2.5 turns, and they're trying to squeeze a half turn at the end of the night.
Late dining, and like everyone's been there since 10 a.m. and now their evening extends another like couple hours later into the night. Yeah. And like,
and I think that was, I actually can't clearly remember, but I think the last episode that I watched, there's some, it ends with Sydney looking at the clock and it's 11 p.m. and she gets a new ticket. And that was like, maybe I misconstrued it, but like it seemed like she was super resentful for having to work so late to fit in that extra half turn. Anyways, it's an interesting and very realistic dynamic. All I remember about the fourth episode is that it ends with their, they find out that they are going to be reviewed by the Chicago Tribune. That's what I remember about the fourth.
Yeah. Or they have been.
Yeah.
The reviewer's been in already, and they just get a call from the Tribune saying that there's a photographer coming to take pictures. Right. Another thing that happens in episode 4 is, well, Sydney's moving out of her dad's place. She gets an apartment. That's like not, I mean, it's important to Sydney's character, but it's not really important to the ongoing story of the show.
Only it is like, because it has important implications to her partnership in the business, I would say, like, because like she has a lot of financial stake, or sorry, more her personal finances are very important for her.
And it's you're right, like they talk about a lot there's like some big hints dropped in the second season that it's, you know, a very precarious position for her to be in and stuff like that. So how that's going to play out is definitely a part of the ongoing story in the third season. We get to spend some time with Richie and his daughter, which was kind of cool. Kind of fun. And then Richie meets his like wife, or I'm sure he's met him before, but like they has a conversation with his ex-wife's fiance. Right.
Yeah, I liked that scene actually quite a lot.
Yeah, me too. For some reason in this episode, we find out that Sugar's husband is going away for a week when it's 2 weeks until she's due to have her baby, which I just think is just such a weird thing. Like, yeah. I don't understand why they threw
What's
that
his job
there.
Again?
I don't remember. Is he going away for work? I don't even remember if he's going away for work. They don't really say.
It's like he's going away for a party, or what do you mean?
What, like just yeah, exactly. Huh. Like a hangout or a vacation or something. She's just like working every day, like all day, and pregnant, and she's probably gonna have her baby early, and yeah, I don't know.
Oh, you know, you know she's delivering that baby on the dining room floor,
yeah,
of the bear.
Like in the restaurant, yeah, in the walk-in while it's locked. Yeah,
yeah.
The Neil Fack puts a picture of all of the critics, every critic in Chicago, up in the wall in the, yeah, office in this episode, which was kind of a fun little.
That's another real. Oh, that's a real thing. Like, again, like I can't remember, yeah, if it's totally in something Will Guadarra wrote. Like, but that, no, I think actually, you know what? It's in. It's certainly in Heat, in Bill Buford's book Heat. He's talking about Babbo, and they had pictures of all of the prominent New York food writers there. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a real thing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, Carmi's like, put them in a binder and put them at the host desk, mm-hmm, or whatever. Is it, I can't remember if it's in this episode. Can't remember what episode it's in. Oh, hopefully it's not in the one that I've seen that you haven't. No, I don't think so. Neil Fack runs a dish to a,
yeah,
table.
Mirepoix.
Yeah, the mirepoix. Yeah. And he pours the broth onto the mirepoix in front of the diners.
Takes it back to the kitchen.
And then he just takes the whole thing back to the kitchen. Yeah.
So that's like, it's a funny scene because that's funny, like to serve, yeah, a dish but then not actually serve it. What is it? What is that dish though? Tell me about mirepoix, Shale.
I don't know. I don't know what that dish is. I mean, obviously it's mirepoix,
mm-hmm,
that's been cut into brunoise, and it's in the bottom of a earthenware bowl. And then they have what I think is chrysanthemum tea.
Oh, is that what something? It is? Yeah. It's kind of pinkish,
I think. Yeah.
Okay.
And they pour that over the dish table side, and they show some close-up shots of the broth or tea or whatever being poured onto the mirepoix. Yeah. And when it is poured on, you see some like droplets of oil floating up on top of the surface, oh, of the broth. And so I'm assuming there's maybe something else in the very bottom of the bowl, or the mirepoix is maybe dressed in something. Mm-hmm. And then there's a flower floating in it as well. Yeah, I don't know. Weird. I'm assuming that it's like about the broth and, you know, just having this like texture of these like barely cooked vegetables or something. Mm. I don't know. It seems like a weird dish to me. Seems like a very
ironic,
like unassuming. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I don't really, I don't know what the deal is with the dish there, but you know, I hope they have an idea of how it would be amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I found this episode a little bit confusing too, because like Sydney runs into somebody at the train station.
Yeah. And that's okay. So that was the CDC at Ever.
Oh.
And so if you remember like the episode where Richie interned there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is right, the right, belligerent CDC who was like,
right. Sick. Oh yeah. Okay. Okay.
So
okay.
That's who,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
was.
Yeah.
But
all right.
Unless okay, I miss something, this is the first time that they tell us point blank that the restaurant is Ever.
Right. Okay. See, okay. Yeah. I was trying, when I watched it the second time, I was trying to listen to what he was saying very carefully, because the first time I watched it, I thought he was a critic up until the point where he tells her that she should come in and eat.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, I guess he's a chef, but maybe he's also a food writer or something. And I didn't recognize him from that.
I'm pretty sure
previous episode. So yeah, that clears that all
up. That episode where Rich is staging there. There's like this running.
He's the guy that comes in and like just like is swearing.
Yeah, exactly. At
people when they're having their meeting stuff. Yeah.
That's the guy.
No, totally. Yeah. Oh yeah. Thanks for pointing that out, because I was very confused about what was going on there. Yeah. So overall, I get the feeling that you're not loving it overall. The beginning
I think,
of this season.
You know what? Like I like watching it. Well, except. Episode two, I thought was actually a lark. Yeah. I really didn't like episode two. Like episode one, I have qualms with, but like it was still a joy for me to watch. Like, so yeah, I'm into it. What?
That sounded like a very non-committal. I'm into it.
Well, I mean, like, what else am I gonna watch?
Yeah, no, that's fair. I'm like, episode five is like pretty interesting, and I mean, and I've seen it and you haven't, and I'm really curious. To get your take on it. I hope that like you know, before we record our episode that that we'll, you know, break down the rest of the season. I hope that we can just like touch base and talk about what you think about episode five, because it is weird.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Can't wait for you to
watch
it.
When you look back at the whole series, what are the one or two episodes that really jump out for you?
It's been so long since I watched the first season that I'm having trouble like really remembering my feels from the first season. But, you know, I think from the first season, the episode where they like sign up for the delivery services and they get whited out, and it's just crazy. Like that definitely, you know, in my memory, that's pretty strong.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Trying to think of what else from the first season I was really like. I mean, the very first episode that I watched, there's like this kind of like thing that they did in the montage in the opening of the third season, as well as they had in the first season. It's like, you know, it's like there's somebody like walking up a street approaching like a bear cage with a bear in it. Or something. Yeah. It's like, I think a dream that Carmi's having or something. And they keep like kind of going back to that. And I just remember like that setting the tone in the very first episode, and then watching the very first episode and being like, oh wow, there's like so much like really cool kitchen culture in here. And it feels, you know, feels quite real. And, you know, and I'm liking the way that it's written. I really remember watching the first episode and being like, wow, there's a show like this. That's cool. Season two, I feel like I have a lot more grasp. I've rewatched it. Like, I rarely rewatch television shows, but I rewatched season two of The Bear like fairly recently. Definitely Forks.
Yeah.
Like, the Forks episode is like a big highlight for me. I just think there's a lot of really cool, authentic sentiment in that episode. I love the introduction of Chef Terry. I'm glad Chef Terry is like still in the show. Like, I was really excited to see that she is still in the show. I was like, I was a little bit shocked that they like gave her a little bit of like bully dialogue.
Five more seconds, Chef. Yeah.
And then like, do you have this? Like, do you need me to finish this for you? Like, you know, just like subtle digs.
And then
it's
interesting, like Carmi appropriated those and used them himself later with other chefs and said, do you need me to finish this? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, and that chef that, and there's just so many cool things in the third season so far. I think, like, you know, that chef that he uses that with is the same chef that Marcus goes and stodges with in Copenhagen or whatever. Yeah. Like, I just, yeah, all those like little connections I think are really cool. Yeah, so Forks in season two is a big highlight for me, and also the Copenhagen episode in season two I really liked. I understand your quibbles, but I don't know. It's just like, I like that it's the kind of show, it like that it has this like kind of authenticity to, you know, like a pretty niche aspect of, you know, a culture that you and I both, you know, like are, you know, very well versed in. Like, I like that there's a show about that. Like, that's cool. But I also like really appreciate that that show feels like it can make an episode where it's just like about one guy that goes to Copenhagen and they just make some bread and stuff. Like, I don't know, like... Mm-hmm. I like that they're willing to take those kinds of risks. I like that they think that they can just make the first episode of the third season a montage. You know, like I appreciate that the show is creative in that mm-hmm. way, you know, and that it's not just trying to like tell this authentic kitchen story. And so we just have to write, you know, like we just have to write this dialogue about kitchens or something, you know, like, and I don't know, I guess like it's pretty, I think, also amazing that the second season just sort of like revolves around the fishes episode. Like, it's so crazy. It's like, you know, it's another one of those huge risks. I feel like, you know, that episode is so intense and it's so crazy and it's so outside of the restaurant aspect of what's going on in the show. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's just like directly centered on like the personal relationship and family aspect of the show. And it's just like an episode out of time and it's so intense and it's hilarious and it's upsetting. And like, I don't know, you know, like I like that the show can just do that, that it feels like they have the freedom to go in whatever direction they want if it feels like it's the best thing for them to tell the story or whatever.
Shale, two years ago-ish, we set out to find the greatest food movies ever made, right?
Uh-huh.
And basically, yep. Like, we had a short list, but basically... it was Ratatouille, Babette's Feast, Big Night, Chef. Those are basically the only, yeah. those are the movies that we had to talk about. Do you think that The Bear, I know it's not a movie, but like mm-hmm. in terms of its depiction of food and kitchen culture, do you think that it is now like in the upper echelon of, depictions of that?
I would say so. Yeah. Whoa. I mean, it's a very different take than something like Babette's yes. Feast, like obviously.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. But
like up there with Ratatouille.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, I think that like, if you're interested in like restaurant culture and food culture, it's kind of hard to ignore
mm-hmm.
The Bear.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's sort of like it's just a part of the conversation now or something. And I think that that's because the people that are working on it want it to actually say something about that culture in a way that is like, in a way that rings true for people who have experience interacting with it. And yeah. And I think that that's sort of like, what's at the heart of what makes those other movies that we talked about good as well.
Yep.
You know, like, I think the same thing that can be said about The Big Night, you know, like Stanley Tucci and other people that worked on that movie really wanted it to feel real in a way that, you know, like that paid respect to the food and how it's made and the way people care about it and the way it affects people's lives. And I think the same can be said for Ratatouille, mm-hmm. you know, like they really wanted to make it feel like real food and real restaurants. And, you know, obviously it's a cartoon or whatever, but you know,
and there's a rat,
you don't bring in Thomas
people.
Keller to design dishes for every cartoon. What's that?
And there's a, and rat, there's a rat controlling somebody's hands by pulling on
controlling
their hair.
A human's hand. Yeah. That's pretty authentic.
That's our secret. That's how we do it in industry.
Shh, Alan, nobody's supposed to know.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.